Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. This is Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, as I continue to get over a little bit of a cold, and we all are enjoying falling back this morning, we're reconnecting with For the People community partner Catalyst CT to begin promoting their Amplifying Resident Voices project, a collaboration with Fairfield University Center for Social Impact and PT Partners, which is expanding on previous research and will assess, design, and implement evidence-based solutions to persistent community violence. Then we're going to connect with the Greater Bridgeport Symphony's board president, touting the symphony's upcoming concert, which is being held in a brand new venue and is going to include a number of ways to engage both musically and creatively with Greater Bridgeport's rich cultural offerings. Then we're going to close with Energize CT, discussing their community partnership initiative, a collaboration with local organizations to connect with and educate residents and business owners about energy efficiency programs available with Energize Connecticut sponsors. But first, yes, as of 2 a.m. this morning, daylight savings time has ended. And while you may enjoy an extra hour of sleep, this disruption in our circadian rhythms, our body's wake and sleep cycles, can have a negative effect on our health. You might wake up earlier, have more trouble falling asleep, or wake up more often during the night. So AARP is highlighting a few things you can do to ease into this transition as we fall back 1 hour today. Try getting some sunlight exposure as soon as you can every morning, because sunlight helps reset your internal clock. Try to go to bed and wake up at roughly the same time every day and avoid any extra dozing before bedtime. Keep your bedroom dark, quiet, and cool. Limit your use of both alcohol and electronic devices before bed and adopt a calming bedtime routine. And finally, make the most of the light in the morning and use that extra hour for a morning workout. And if you can't exercise in the morning, it's still a good idea to incorporate some activity into your day. Well, as we indicated in our introduction, we are visiting again with Mark Donald, representing Catalyst CT, and we wanted to touch base with him as they begin to expand on the utilization of their $1 million TOE Foundation grant to create the Amplifying Resident Voices Project, an exciting initiative that we hope that we can inspire involvement with on the part of all you folks who are listening this morning or tuning in on the podcast. Mark, appreciate you being with us here. And I guess before we begin, there's a lot of other stuff going on. We've talked to you a number of times over the past 8 or 10 months, and regular listeners have a really good idea of how many ways your organization, Catalyst CT, is working to impact and improve a number of widespread health and wellness and response initiatives. But, here as we're entering the first couple days of November, and as we tape this, the government shutdown had not yet taken effect here on the 28th of October, but it is not looking like it is going to change by the time we broadcast this on Sunday morning. Regardless of whether that happens or not, it's not like you can flip a switch and then everything that's been building up to this moment kind of goes away. Let's talk a little bit about how you have been kind of watching this oncoming storm and are working with your staff to try to be as best prepared as possible on behalf of all the people you serve.
Yeah, thanks, John. I appreciate you having me on once again. And as is unfortunately predictable, especially in the broad range of work that we use, is times like these only increase the demand for our services. Unfortunately, with so much uncertainty and especially a lot of the federal funding cuts, that makes our access to resources and funding to do the work a little more of a challenge. A good example is just this morning we received an updated contract for our suicide prevention efforts that has a $25,000 cut in it. And with things being uncertain and bleak, it obviously has a big impact on the mental health of folks around, and, you know, poor coping skills, turning to substances and avoiding the important pieces of self-care, eating correctly, getting enough sleep, that can lead to greater suicide attempts. So, you know, it's definitely a challenge. Strategically, we are being cognizant of everything that is going on and trying to find strategic partners. Obviously, with November 1st coming around as of yesterday, and SNAP benefits, the food insecurity is a massive issue, which, of course, we don't deal with. But if people aren't fed, housed, and mentally well, then everything else goes by the wayside.
Mm. We on our last week's program, we were talking to the director from Connecticut Food Share, who was also anticipating that things were probably not going to be changing by the 1st of November. And he indicated that the last government shutdown gave that organization, to the extent that it's replicated, a bit of a test run, or at least kind of testing the limitations and their ability to respond to such challenges. Do you recall how Catalyst CT reacted during the prior government shutdown a few years back?
Well, that was prior to my time at the helm here, so I can't speak to it directly. I think one of the things we're known for is being adaptable and adjusting to community need. So that's at the forefront also of this one. I think the other piece of it is, this is not analogous to the COVID situation where we quote unquote knew where the enemy was coming from with the issue. And we actually stepped up with some food distribution through some of our normal community work. This doesn't seem to be that case. And, I think with us, the direct federal impacts has already happened, including that cut that came through this morning through the contract. So in terms of resources, that is going to be long term. But with the government shutdown and the food insecurity and, joblessness picking up, that's issues we deal with a little bit downstream with, families that are getting a little more desperate to fulfill basic needs. And, with desperation comes some extreme actions. So whether that's, keeping youth from engaging in criminal activity to getting them in out of trouble when they do it, to supporting communities and neighborhoods and addressing some behavioral health needs. We're trying to get ahead about it and finding strategic partners too. So when resources get scarce, we're not trying to do more with less. We're trying to leverage the strengths of others to get the work done.
Yeah. Over the past few weeks, have you sort of seen the capacity meter starting to push toward the red zone in terms of increased volumes of calls or needing to keep your team members engaged with individual clients longer because they're so anxious, stressed, or frantic?
Yeah, you definitely see an uptick in the stress meter of everybody, including employees who, the number one role that I'm trying to take right now is to support the employees, ensure that they're practicing their own self-care. They're taken care of. They're not trying to do more with less, but taking a step back and looking where they can leverage other resources to create the impact. Part of the, you know, kind of the blessing and the curse of many nonprofit and social service employees, it's they're so passionate and so dedicated, they will work themselves to the bone to try and get it done and do more with less. And I think that's the theme that I'm trying to preach is, you know, get your head up, take care of yourself, put your oxygen mask on, and then take care of the families you serve, because then we can serve it more efficiently and in a better way by, you know, leveraging resources out there. You know, a good example of that is with food insecurity. You know, can we partner with food pantries that may typically be reliant on the families coming to them? Instead, can we pick up food and deliver it to the families to reduce a stressor that they may be having?
Very good. How can our listeners potentially help in the communities that you serve? We know from our repetitive conversations with food service organizations that cash donations that help them multiply the buying power that they have to acquire food in bulk may be one of the greatest benefits that an individual who may never have even donated money to a philanthropic cause before can do the most good. How can folks most help Catalyst CT?
Well, certainly the donations are the most useful and impactful on our end. Our work is so reliant on the generosity and the largesse of the community we serve that helps multiply the impact, because we are very efficient with the funding. We make sure it goes to the families and the people that we support. And most importantly, the money that's donated to us really becomes a multiplying exponentially impact on the families and we serve. So that's the biggest thing. Obviously, going to catalystct.org, we have a broad range of initiatives and activities that you know, people may want to be involved in, and they can certainly reach out to us there. Interacting with our social media, Catalyst NCT on Instagram, Catalyst CT on Facebook, and then Catalyst CT on LinkedIn as well. All places you can find out more about what we do and look to get involved.
Excellent. Good. Well, as you're dealing with this, obscure next few days and weeks, and your team answers the call, there's also much to celebrate in terms of this Tao Foundation grant and your partnership with Fairfield University Center for Social Impact and PT Partners on this three-year, $1 million program to continue developing research on gun violence prevention. Let's talk about amplifying resident voices and what we need to know about that at this point.
Yeah, I think that's indicative of some of the partnership work that I'm preaching right now about what we need to do. And fortunately, we have some great partners with Fairfield University Center for Social Impact, as well as PT Partners, which is a resident-led public housing group that is committed to giving community voice in all things. We approached it. It kind of grew out of a youth gun violence task force that we led during the pandemic, where all of the kind of best practices and research really came from outside of where the narrative was the gun violence was happening. So we engaged with support of the Tao Foundation on a project to survey and do focus groups with residents of public housing to find out really like what is the best way to combat this from your point of view. And we're a little over halfway through the project right now. We just had the first round of survey data and focus groups. And it's been really, really tremendous in terms of giving us added insight from the people who are closest to what is perceived as the problem to help solve it. And one of, you know, some collateral benefits have been the sense of community that has really been created. Just Friday, we presented the survey data to the residents, and we had over 100 residents from Green Homes, from P.T. Barnum Complex and Trumbull Gardens join us on a Friday night. That gives you an idea of how invested they are in their own voice and in the impact. Some of the early returns are that we're finding out is that, you know, a lot of the incidents of violence that's happening inside of public housing is not actually conducted by residents of the public housing units. It's people from outside bringing the guns in. And obviously some other things where they're concerned about young people, and young people are voicing their interest in working and a workforce development that's meaningful for them, which can help address some of the behaviors that may be happening when they're not engaged in productive pieces. But the overall project has been very enlightening, enriching. We will have a public event in the not too distant future to kind of celebrate that halfway point and share the results of the interim data. And then once we get that data, we're going to start trying to implement, but also make some policy recommendations. I think too often, you know, the disenfranchised voices are not heard or considered, and the solutions are coming from external and from people who do not live. So this gives them an opportunity to offer their solutions. We can test them out to see if they're working and continue to iterate.
As you gathered everyone together there on that Friday evening, and revealed some of the initial data points that were emerging from your work so far, were there any that you recall that, you know, really, you know, resonated with the crowd and inspired additional input? Opinions, conversations during the event?
I mean, you know, you leave an event like that and you're absolutely buzzing because of the positivity and the energy that that people have with seeing physical representations. We did a data walk, which, you know, Fairfield University did big boards representing the data. Mm-hmm. And I particularly kind of quote-unquote hosted one on mental health. And I think to date, a lot of the stigma around mental health has been quite the challenge. And for me, it was very enlightening and important for so many people to recognize the impact on mental health, but more in terms of a proactive way. And I had one gentleman, 59-year-old gentleman, told me extensively about his trauma history. And you think about that age demographic with a resident, inner urban resident, they're not typically the ones who are going to be forthcoming about their mental health struggles. But I think him acknowledging that and so many others acknowledge the impact on mental health means, okay, we realize there's an issue and here are some practical ways we can address it. You know, if we don't acknowledge the problem, then we can't address it. And I think that's one thing that's coming out as well.
Now, we mentioned PT partners. What role are they playing up to now, and will they play through the conclusion of this initiative?
Oh, yeah. They're critical because they're the group of residents. They've already formed and done a lot of the kind of capacity building within resident leaders. The resident leaders have led the surveys. We co-created the surveys together with, like I said, with Fairfield U and PT Partners. So they were critical in shaping the project as well as delivering it. You know, it would be difficult for me, who is not a resident of public housing, to go in and do a survey because I'm just seen as somebody that's you know, somebody coming in to get some information, then leave and not do anything about it. Whereas our resident leaders have that credibility and trust. So when they say, you know, we want your voice and we're going to come back, well, they're the ones who are accountable to the people whose voice we're getting. So that trust is already built. We in Fairfield, you don't have to go in and build that trust.
Right.
I think that's the key, and that's part of that partnership area I preach, because PT Partners does some great work around building that resident voice. We obviously have a broad community presence, as well as the Street Safe Gun Violence Intervention. And then Fairfield U has research and academic experience. So between the three of us, the partnership is, you know, pardon the pun on the project term, but it amplifies.
Yes, yes. Well, I'm glad we've had a chance to catch up on this, Mark, and look forward to our next conversation as you begin to steer the Amplifying Community Voices project toward its eventual conclusion and outcomes. Particularly, we'll enjoy talking about some of the recommendations that this will yield and permit Catalyst CT and yourself and your partners to bring forward to begin to make the change that the data gathering promised to the folks that you're serving there in Greater Bridgeport. Catalyst CT is working to be part of the solution to reduce youth and gun violence, to advocate for healthier communities, and create a positive impact that extends far beyond today. Their leaders, Mark Donald, always great to have his voice on For the People. And Mark, thank you again for your time today. We'll look forward to catching up on the next chapter in a couple of months. Well, one of my favorite things to do is talk cultural arts on the award-winning For the People, and bringing it home to regions like Greater Bridgeport. We're pleased again to welcome Mark Halstead. He's the board president for the Greater Bridgeport Symphony. They are amidst their 80th season and exploring new horizons. Their next concert is coming up on November 15th, and it's an exciting activity to talk about, because this is way more than a symphony concert, and it's happening in a brand new place. So lots to talk about with Mark, but also lots to talk about when it comes to Connecticut teens and traffic safety. You don't have to look further than news media, social network, and headlines to know how we are losing way too many of our young people in traffic-related emergencies and incidents. And Connecticut teens in their high schools can now win up to $26,000 in prizes by entering a submission into Connecticut's 17th annual Teen Safe Driving Video Contest. It's hosted by the Connecticut Department of Motor Vehicles and Travelers. The contest is open to all public, private, and homeschooled high school students in Connecticut between the ages of 14 and 18. Students entering are required to produce a creative, unique, and effective video public service announcement up to 45 seconds in length that highlights interactions between drivers and other teens and illustrates ways to practice safer driving habits while addressing at least one specific Connecticut teen driving law. You can get all the contest rules and information on how to submit a video entry by going to ct.gov/teendriving/contest. All right, Mr. Halstead, thank you so much for joining us again on For the People. You've got an exciting event coming up on November 15th. But before we talk about that, let's talk about this 80th season. How has it been going so far? What are your reactions amongst the greater patronage about our new maestro, Eduardo?
Well, it's been a good start. We had our first concert on October the 4th, and Eduardo put together a really great program. It culminated with a Shostakovich Fifth Symphony, which was so good, and we had a larger number of musicians than we've put on stage in a few years, so it's feeling good we're getting back to full complement. And it really it just came off the stage so strong. And we had a wonderful violin solo by Bernilda Misteraj, who's new to us and a friend of Eduardo's, and she was fabulous. So we had a wonderfully textured concert. The theme of this year is New Horizons, and what we want to do is Eduardo wanted to put something together that brought us into different realms of music. So there was a very new piece from maybe 15 years ago that was part of the concert as well, which, of course, some of our concert goers said, I don't know about that. But we're making people think, and we're making people see other sides of orchestral music. So they got the best of the old and the best of the new, and we'll continue that all through this season. And we actually have also themed each concert by one of the classical elements, so earth, water, fire, air, and the fifth one, Quintessence, which we'll do in December. And this was the air concert, so the Lark Ascending was perfect for that. Felt like we were flying the whole time. And our audience is really enjoying Eduardo. We got great reviews from him for him when he was our guest conductor for a season. And he's just continued just charming the audience, amazing the audience. We keep hearing how much he's growing into this orchestra and growing into our audience. So it's a great time for GBS.
He'll be enjoying some flavors of home, so to speak, on November 15th as GBS presents Horizons of Fire. But before we talk about the music and his diving into some of this Heider Villa-Lobos material, we want to make sure that there aren't any people driving into the Klein parking lot that evening wondering why they got such a good parking place.
We've been a little worried about that. We might actually put somebody up there who will have to miss the first 15 minutes of the concert just to make sure. You know that we love the Klein. Klein's been home to us since 1946. With just a short hiatus when the Klein was being renovated. And we actually, at that time, went to the same venue we'll be at on November 15th, which is at the University of Bridgeport, the Mertens Theater, which is a smaller theater. It's 900 seats versus the Klein's 1,500. And it's much better suited to this concert, and our March concert as well will be held at the Mertens Theater. The crowds for those concerts are generally a little smaller, so we won't be swimming in the big space. We'll feel a little more intimate in this space, which I think will be great. It's something that Eduardo was very concerned that we do, is this music wants to bring you close to it, bring you the fire element of its fiery music, but also he talks about it as being, it's a warmth for the beginning of winter. This theater is a wonderful theater. It's a much more radial. Everyone's closer to the stage. We're looking forward to it. And it will have different possibilities for us. We're looking at different things we can do to create a different type of presentation for the music. But one of the coolest things is the building that it's in is the former arts building for the University of Bridgeport. So there's a great gallery right across the hall from the concert hall. And we're teaming up with City Lights of Bridgeport, who's going to be having an exhibition in that space, so people can come and meander through beautiful art before and during the concert and intermission, and then have our music. So we're bringing together the visual and the audio arts at the same time, and we hope it'll be a very cross-cultural experience in that sense, not cross-cultural, but yeah. you get a real sense of more than just something you hear. It's something you see. It's something you experience. It's something you take out of the hall with you and lifts you up.
Right. Something, a couple things. Does the alteration of the size of the hall mean that you're going kind of back to right-sizing the orchestra from that expanded number of musicians that we saw in October?
Well, this one is a smaller number of musicians. This is an all-strings concert, and it's our very best of our strings, which are just fantastic professionals. They're all virtuosi. And so that will be part of this, that being closer to the stage with a smaller number of musicians, we want that to feel great for people and to experience our string section. And in March, we'll do something a little different where we're going to bring in some different instruments. We're actually having something in the same hall written for harp and saxophone. So this will be something different and something you want to be closer to see how the music is made.
Well, one of the other exciting components of this activity at the Mertens space at the University of Bridgeport is the integration of students from Bridgeport's Keys program, Kids Empowered by Your Support, that's going to provide music as folks stroll through the gallery over yes. there and look at some of the art on display in partnership with City Lights. This illustrates another component of why GBS is playing such an important role in introducing people who may be the next generation of virtuoso artists on the stage.
You're absolutely right. And the Keys program, for anyone out there not familiar with it, is about, I think they're about 20 years old, maybe a little older. But this is an organization that's really dedicated to bringing free music education to kids in Bridgeport, an underserved population with music that unfortunately don't get a whole lot of music in the school system. They do the best they can, but a program like this is bringing orchestral music. And every Saturday morning, they have a huge group of kids that come in at all levels. Instruments are provided for them, and the education for them is provided by, in some cases, our own GBS musicians are their mentors. But the really interesting component is as these kids get older, some of them get good enough to become teachers by the time they're in high school. So you're seeing this generational turnover within the group itself. And we're very proud to be working with them. And Eduardo is going to be visiting with them once a month all season long to coach and conduct the various sessions with them. He's loved being with them. He's visited them a number of times now. And again, it's sort of like coming home because the mentors he sees there are the same musicians sitting in front of him at our concerts. So it's just a great way for him to be integrated in the community. And so to have these kids from Keys playing in the gallery is, we look at those kids as being the bridge to the future. And our audience loves it when they see what we're doing in Bridgeport especially, but other communities as well. We do go to other schools. We want the music out there for the next generation.
Yeah, and when you try to extract the maximum benefit from anything like the Greater Bridgeport Symphony, you look at outreach and collaborations like Kids Empowered by Your Support, the Keys program, and you see the way something as collateral as a regional symphony orchestra and its members going out into the community are having a fundamental impact potentially on the academic health and well-being of students in Greater Bridgeport, because you know, it's a long-standing scientific fact that kids that are involved with music, especially playing an instrument, just naturally do better academically.
Yes. And we're so proud of our kids that come to us and that we're able to do our bit to help them to grow as people, as students, as thinkers for the future. It's great to see this. And we actually, one of the things we want to get going again that we had federal money for 3 years, we had a program where we mentored students all season long. Our musicians would mentor different sections. We had some trumpets, some string kids, and we mentored them. They auditioned for Eduardo, and Eduardo took the best of them and put them on the stage during our concerts. And it was a magic experience to see that nobody noticed that there's three 17-year-old trumpets, actually two 16-year-olds, one 17-year-old in the back row with the brass section. Mm. And that was at one of our holiday concerts a couple of years ago. And Eduardo, at the end of it, said, "Didn't you think that sounded great? Wasn't the brass section especially good? You notice anybody back there looks really young?" And the audience said, "Oh, wow, look, these are kids." And these are kids playing with the adults. They're playing as, you know, right up on par with the adults. But the great thing for them is that these are kids thinking about a musical career. What's it like to be part of a professional orchestra? What does it mean to be at rehearsal at 7 o'clock and stay till 10 and put your whole into that and to practice for that those weeks in advance, to be expected to do everything a professional musician does? And I love seeing what happens on the stage. And I love seeing that people appreciate that, that when they know that the kids are up there with the adults, it just makes the experience all the greater.
Yep, and packing even more into a evening with the symphony is, of course, a pre-concert talk with Dr. Frank Martignetti, who's going to guide concert goers through the music of the program, which we really need to get to as time is beginning to run out of the hourglass here, Mark. Let's talk about this program that we'll be seeing at the University of Bridgeport's Mertens Theater on November 15th.
Oh, one of the wonderful things that Eduardo's brought to us is he brings us the flavor of South America in the music. And in this concert, it opens with two pieces from South America, one from Brazil, one from Argentina, by Villa-Lobos, the other by Piazzolla. And they're both really grounded in classical. So Villa-Lobos' piece is an homage to Bach, but it's done with South American rhythm. It brings in a different sort of fire. That's exactly what we wanted to do with our Horizons of Fire. And then Piazzolla actually is famous for actually accordion playing tangos. There's tango rhythms that he puts into a piece that is based on Vivaldi. It's based on the Four Seasons, but he calls it the Four Seasons of Buenos Aires. So this is a guy, too, that grew up half in Greenwich Village and half in Buenos Aires. And so he's got this great cross-continental vibe to his music. Mm. So the whole first half is going to be very different than anything we would have played in the past. We really haven't played a lot of South American composers. So this is something Eduardo's bringing us right off the bat. And then it comes, he wants to take those folk rhythms that are in those two South America pieces, and he brings us Bartok piece, which Bartok was famous for bringing in Hungarian rhythms into the music, Hungarian folk music into classical. So it's a lot of storytelling. There's a lot of feeling of culture, different cultures, how they react to classical music. It is a real living, breathing way of showing the relevance of classical music that goes into all cultures, since the stuff was written 400, 500 years ago in some cases, that it still has great relevance today, and it still has resonates through different cultures, different parts of the world, and comes out in its own special way.
And both of these sections of the program are going to be bringing in yet another fantastic soloist.
Yes, indeed. We're really looking forward to the violinist in this case. He's going to be fantastic. That all of these pieces have a strong violin component, and him leading the string section is going to be fantastic.
Yes, Tong Chen. Has he? Have you seen him play before?
No, but he is another connection of Eduardo's. Eduardo, with his vast academic background, he knows people. He knows younger musicians from so many walks of life, so many different sections. So this is a connection of Eduardo's. We're very much looking forward to seeing him. We know when Eduardo gets excited about a musician, it's worth getting excited about.
Well, we'd certainly love for folks to come out on November 15th to enjoy this program and to get there early for the talk, the gallery experience, and everything offered at the Bernhardt Center at the University of Bridgeport. But we would also love folks to consider patronizing the Greater Bridgeport Symphony, especially since they still have some great programs to present for this 80th season.
Yes, indeed. We hope that we'll see a lot of new friends this season in the concert hall. We have a fantastic program in December that's going to feature Benjamin Britten's Young People's Guide to the Orchestra. So this is a place to bring the kids to get them interested in that. But then so much of the rest of the concert is just celebratory, wonderful, happy seasonal music. It happens right in the middle of Hanukkah and 5 days before Christmas. So that's going to be a fun night for everybody. I wish we We could have five dates in halls to do it because there's so much good to spread around with that. And then we have the two other concerts in March and April, and both of those are going to be wonderful showcases for our musicians, our new conductor. And we're thrilled that we're 80 years old, and we're looking forward to the next 80. It's the beginning of a lot of things.
GBS.org is where you could start or continue your journey with the Greater Bridgeport Symphony as they continue their 80th season exploring new horizons. The Spirits and Rhythms of South America are heading up their November 15th concert, happening not at the Klein, but at the Mertens Theater in the Bernhardt Center at the University of Bridgeport. We hope folks will come out to hear this fantastic program or to reconnect to the orchestra if you've been away for some time, and bring a younger person who you think might enjoy the music and the experience.
Kids under 19 are free.
There you go. No reason not to, and we'll fill all of those 400 plus
How many? We want all 900 seats.
All 900.
So everybody,
yes,
come on out.
Fill all 900 seats there at the Mertens Theater. Mark Halstead is the engaging chairman of the board for the Greater Bridgeport Symphony. He's been a great guest of ours here in the past, and we look forward to chatting with you again in the future about this great effort. Mark, thank you so much. Well, we like to talk about energy savings whenever possible here on the award-winning For the People, particularly these days when unsurety and so many other local, state, national, and global factors are impacting businesses, trying to find ways for businesses, particularly in distressed areas, to enjoy maximum energy savings. And that's why we are so pleased to have with us Ricardo Jordan. He's manager of energy efficiency at Eversource, talking about Energize Connecticut's community partnership initiative. And we're going to tell you all about that after we tell you about this exciting new development on another kind of energy related front. Connecticut residents now have a new way to recycle small gas cylinders at no cost, thanks to the launch of the Cylinder Collective, a nonprofit producer responsibility organization created to run the state's first gas cylinder stewardship program. TCC partners with manufacturers, municipalities, and collection sites to provide residents with a free, convenient, and environmentally responsible recycling solution for residential gas cylinders. The program, required under Connecticut laws of October 1st, provides free collection sites around Connecticut, including at transfer stations, recycling facilities, municipal events, and select state parks. Residents can visit cylindercollective.org to find your nearby collection site and learn more. All right, Ricardo, how are you this morning?
I'm doing fantastic, John. How are you doing?
Good. So we are here today to talk about the Energize Connecticut Community Partnership Initiative and to tout a number of projects that have benefited from this grant program that's attached to this effort in areas that are listening to our program. So let's get right into the subject matter. What is the Community Partnership Initiative?
Well, in a few words, I mean, the Partnership Initiative really focuses on education and awareness, especially in a lot of our underserved towns, underserved neighborhoods. What the initiative allows us to do is collaborate and partner with local organizations and connect our residents, our business owners, with information about these energy efficiency programs that are available through the Energize CT initiative, which Eversource is one of the main sponsors of. You know, with this partnership, what we look to do is we look to partner with any of the, you know, local organizations that are already in the community. We foster any existing trusted relationships, any experience with local groups, local community groups, nonprofits, and just increase awareness of a lot of our award-winning programs. I'll give you some examples. You know, we've got programs that focus strictly on small businesses called the Small Business Energy Advantage Program. And we also have programs that focus on our multifamily properties. And then last but not least, we have a program called the Home Energy Solutions Program, which focuses on our homeowners, our residents. And we look at, you know, increasing our heat pump adoption as well, because electrification is one of our big things right now with Energy ICT.
Great. Well, let's break it down and talk about these energy efficiency programs one-to-one. And starting with the one you just talked about, Home Energy Solutions and this heat pump adoption and multifamily initiative.
Yeah. You know, the Home Energy Solutions are sort of portfolio programs, including, you know, multifamily and the heat pump programs that we have, are designed to improve a home or an apartment's energy efficiency, really, by providing customers with energy savings and essentially a more comfortable way of living, a more comfortable environment. We have contractors, technicians that are vetted and approved by us at Eversource Energy ICT that perform a slew of services on site, do an assessment. Think of it like getting a physical for your home. And even on site, right when that assessment is done, could already do some really low-cost energy improvements, such as air sealing and things like that, some insulation work. But they conduct a full-blown assessment of your home and then put together an energy savings report and then proceed with scheduling. And these contractors that work with us, they take you through the entire process, start to finish, very seamless and very good for our homeowners.
Now, are there any limitations in regards to the multifamily initiative in terms of how many properties a landlord may own could potentially benefit, or any other stipulations to a someone seeking heat pump adoption in their own home versus in a rental unit?
With our multifamily program, we call it the Multifamily Initiative. The more properties, the better. We want to work with all of our multifamily property owners across the state in all of our communities. You know, we can work with our renters. We can work with our multifamily owners. There's no limitations there. You know, our programs are available for everybody.
We also know that you, as we mentioned earlier, want to reach out and engage even more with the small business community, and that's where the Small Business Energy Advantage Program comes in. Let's hear more about that.
Yes, you know, very similar to our residential programs, we have utility authorized, fully vetted contractors that approach our small businesses in our communities and conduct a no-cost, no obligation energy assessment of the business's facility. And again, put together an energy savings report based on their findings, and they pretty much take care of everything from there. It's a one-stop shop, one-stop service. And even with combining the incentives that we have through our small business program, one of the other really enticing components of the program that we have for our small businesses is that we're able to provide very, very attractive financing options for our small businesses. Our small businesses, they're focused on their operations. They're focused on their personnel. And that's where the resources from our small business program come into play. We can provide and offer zero interest on bill payment options through our financial our financing programs that we have. And this allows businesses to get started right away with doing these energy saving improvements, and they can just pay for the projects over time directly on their utility bill.
Yeah.
And as they realize the savings from the installations, from those energy assessments, it's almost seamless. Yeah, and we work with all kinds of businesses in our small business program.
Yeah, I was going to say, Ricardo, don't tune out of the program just because it's branded for businesses, because I like the fact nonprofit organizations could take advantage of it. Libraries, museums, meeting centers, and places of worship as well.
Oh, absolutely, yes. Libraries, museums, even small office settings. You know, there's a lot of our neighborhoods and a lot of our towns have small law offices, doctor's offices, dentist offices. My dentist works out of a really small office. And these programs are perfect for customers like that. And as you mentioned, nonprofits especially, even assisted living facilities, you know, meeting centers, car washes, gyms. You know, we've got some criteria based on consumption, but we've got a large pool of small businesses. And we have programs for everybody.
Great. So how are applicants selected?
Well, for the community partnership initiative, selections are based on the applications and the proposals that come with. You know, during the application process, our applicants had to put together an outline of their different goals, because at the community level, you know, they're engaging us through this program, through this initiative, because they have certain ideas in mind, certain goals in mind. So they have to outline what those specific goals are and the different methods and efforts that they plan to implement using the funds that come from the partnership initiative. And additionally, you know, all of our applicants were asked to describe, you know, what would the roles and responsibilities be of those local stakeholders, the boots on the ground, if you will, in their efforts. And including any other community-based organizations that they would partner with, could partner with, if they were to receive the funding. And essentially, you know, how would they go about increasing that awareness? And we evaluate, you know, their responses, and we try to make sure there's an actual fit that supports what Energize CT and our initiatives are looking to do.
Great. Well, let's look at some of the ways that grants from this program are being applied, and start in my hometown of Waterbury with Riba Aspira and their Clean Water Action and Nest Incorporated. What is that project involve?
Yeah, through the Waterbury Coalition, you know, we're looking to increase participation in our income-eligible home energy solutions program. Through the campaign, it's actually a very specific campaign in Waterbury called the Waterbury Home Energy Action Campaign. This coalition actually within Waterbury, they've been working with the partnership since our first round of applications, since our inception, which was back in 2021. And then we're looking to continue to work with them as they've established a really strong footing there in Waterbury, and they got a lot of good things going on there.
Great. I want to jump around the list a little bit to make sure we're hitting a number of communities we serve, including Bridgeport, Stratford, and then up the Route 8 corridor all the way almost to Massachusetts, with Torrington and Winchester also participating in the Live Green Connecticut program.
And again, there, you know, you'll hear me talk about home energy solutions quite often, because it's very important that we increase our program participation with our residents, especially through our income eligible offering. But as you said, yeah, you know, we're not just looking to increase assessments through our home energy solutions program, but also increase heat pump adoption in those towns like Bridgeport, Stratford, Torrington, Winchester. Now, this is the first time that Live Green Connecticut is participating in the partnership, and we're really excited about that. And the efforts there within Live Green are going to be concentrated in two different areas. The first is going to be focused on working with community partners and residents in Bridgeport and Stratford. And then the second campaign will be looking to target residents in Torrington and in Winchester. So being very strategic with location, but definitely excited to work with Live Green Connecticut.
Great. And let's bring it back all the way down here to the city of New Haven. They've been a successful partner with you guys through two rounds of this program involving home energy solutions. Now in round three, they're going to be working with our friends at Community Action Agency of New Haven.
Yeah, city of New Haven is returning. They're coming back for more, and We're really excited about that, too. And as you mentioned, you know, they're going to be partnering with the Community Action Agency at New Haven. You know, the Action Agency is actually currently an administrator of a very, very strong program called the Connecticut Energy Assistance Program. That program is really important. It provides utility bill assistance for Connecticut residents that have household incomes that are at or below certain federal poverty guidelines or receive benefits from the Department of Social Services. It's a strong program to have in place that really, you know, helps out our residents, you know, looking at utility bills. It's very important because we're looking at energy all the time, but we're also looking at costs. And one of the other things about the Community Action Agency at New Haven is that they're going to look at, you know, focusing on educating the benefits of things like heat pumps, but also weatherization. Weatherization is very important, not just for homeowners, but also for businesses. See, you know, inside of a home or inside of a business, you know, moving air in and out of different spaces, conditioning that air, making it hot, making it cold, whether you're in the summer or in the winter, costs a lot of money to do that, a lot of energy. And you want to make sure that that air is not leaving the facility, not leaving your home. If it leaves, it's like dollar bills with wings just flying out. You don't want that to happen. Right. So weatherization looks at tightening the shell, making sure everything is concentrated within, you know, within the space. So the Community Action Agency is looking at providing education on all the benefits of that. And they're going to be looking to reach out to all of their clientele within the city of New Haven and focusing on providing that education. And I'm really excited about the continued partnership with the city.
Ricardo Ricky Jordan is Eversource's Energy Efficiency Manager, and he's been talking with us about Energize CT's Community Partnership Initiative. Energize Connecticut is dedicated to empowering Connecticut to make smart energy choices now and in the future. You certainly got a great idea through our chat this morning about how the program is doing that throughout communities here in Connecticut, and we very much appreciate your time, Ricky. If you need more information or want to keep track to find out when the next round of Community Partnership Initiative program and applications are going to launch, you can go to energizect.com. Ricky, thank you so much for your time today.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a PSA for our program that's relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to john.vocat@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program can be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station websites. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs John Vocat. Join us again at this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime. Just find it under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.